the organizers of this event for having invited me. It's the eighth time that I've been in Nashik. And the first time I came was right after the meeting was unlike it. Seems like a secret compatible right there. But it also makes these events, especially this one, kind of unforgettable, because I would be crying and I would be going crazy throwing food around the house if I wasn't here in a very friendly place celebrating one of my great friends in Prague. I've been working on financialization for quite some time, and it's a fascinating concept for heterodox economists of all kinds. Partly because the way standard economic theory looks at finance, which is in a very, very limited way. So financialization itself is by its very nature a heterodox concept and has been picked up by different heterodox traditions, notably by post-Keynesians, Marxists, Marxists of different kinds, including the American Monopoly Capital Kind of School, the Bellamy Foster, the Urbi Radicals, the French regulationists. So already just looking at the concept in a kind of a history of economic thought way, literature analysis would give you a very good idea also as to how the different heterodox approaches overlap and also are different from each other. But when you sort of do this literature search in heterodox economics in recent decades, you realize that these approaches tend to look at specific aspects of financialization without giving you a broad overview. Right? And while any of this work is relevant, because it is ultimately a very complex and multifaceted phenomenon, and you know each contribution sheds light on a particular dimension of this phenomenon, we lack both a holistic approach and a dynamic approach. And so I was trying to do that a little bit better than the kind of my colleagues have tried to do. And so I was trying to see how I can contextualize financialization in all its complexity, both historically as well as theoretically. And I've been trying to do that through this notion of finance-led capitalism, which is also the title of my last book. You have to understand where I'm coming from. I have been trying to bridge different heterodox traditions. When I was young, I was a Marxist, pure and pure. And then I ended up, thanks to my post-Keynesian friends, when I came to the States, not least because of Craig was my first boss in the U.S., I ended up with the post-Keynesians. And then I, you know, on the day Reagan got elected, I went to first time at Saint-Permat, which is the center of French regulation school. And on the day Reagan was elected, yes, I became a regulationist. So I've been bridging these different traditions, right? And this comes back from something that happened to me when I was 19 years old and I was a second year student in Vienna. The person came that I had no clue who he was, his name was Ernest Mondel, and he was a Marxist economist, and he convinced me about long waves. And all I've been trying to do since 1970 was to try to understand long waves. And I found that the regulationists have an approach for that makes sense, which is to sort of periodicize historically the evolution of capitalism through those long waves, right? Through distinct accumulation regimes with their unique specific modes of regulation. And in that sense, I'm mostly a regulationist, and I ended up working in Paris for the last 5 years. Together, you know, I split my time between New York and Paris, and I have a bunch of students here that came to Paris, and I recommend the other students to try and come as well, because CEPI, where I work, is actually an interesting place. Now, in this context, of long waves, basically, you have periods 20, 30 years, like in the 50s and 60s, or from 1982 to 2007, of rapid growth and very short and shallow recessions. It's typically also the time when the standard economists think that they have resolved all the problems of economics, and you know, they call it like the Great Moderation and so forth. Typically also just before the big crisis hits. So then they get very embarrassed, which is kind of a good moment for us to intervene. Now, this last phase, so the post-Fordist phase, because Fordist regulation regime collapsed in this deflation crisis, when you understand also regulation theory, you realize that it has to do with the interaction. A regulation is the self-balancing of the system. Right? And the system, the capitalist system, balances itself through both crisis and then reforms. And I'll talk a little bit about this, especially tomorrow, because I try to explain to you how I see a transition to a new regime emerging right now, which I would call ecological capitalism, which seems to be a contradiction in terms, but I will tell you why I think it may work. And ironically, I also think that Trump will ultimately accelerate that transition. But that's another story for tomorrow. But the last one, previously, is the stagflation crisis. And these five institutional pillars are the wage relation, competition, which includes also a large technological dimension, and also the kind of input-output analysis framework between sectors, money, and the state, and the international context of international relations, right? These are five institutional pillars that dominate the capitalist system, and they have to interact in a particular motion that makes an accumulation regime. And when those five are in a constellation that works, then you have fairly rapid growth, right? And you can look at different periods of capitalism where this actually happens, right? But you also then see the pattern being that at the end of that upswing phase, you get a big crisis. So you also have a pattern of systemic crisis, the financial dimension of the crisis, of the big crisis, then becoming structural crisis, which is the more production-based dimension of this crisis. You get great crisis. The regulations call this great crisis, right? And they have a systemic dimension, which is a financial dimension, and a structural dimension, which is basically overproduction, underconsumption, feeding each other, right? So then you get long periods of stagnation, crisis-ridden periods. So we are not in the middle of one, but we're certainly in one. And US Brazilians can certainly testify to that quite well. Because the last time I was here, it was a different kind of society. Right? And the question then, of course, the crucial question is how do we get out of this? Right? How do we get into the next phase? And then the next phase is how capitalism redoes itself. And this is a matter of great theoretical importance for us to understand. Right? It's a matter of going back to Marxist counter-tendencies against the tendency of the fallen profit, right? I mean, capitalism organizes itself through a crisis, reorganizes itself through a crisis. And in that sense, I'm still a Marxist. The counter-tendencies are crucial. And then you have, on top of that, you also have a Schumpeterian pattern of cluster-like technological revolutions, which actually happen when capital has to be devalorized rapidly and prices fall. So the cluster-like technological revolutions happen in a particular set of time frameworks, right? So there's a Schumpeterian dimension there. And then there is, of course, kind of a policy reform. And the policy reform happens to be crucially involved with reforms of money and finance. And that's a sort of a Minskian long wave dimension. Minsky had a long wave dimension too, early on in his work starting in 1964. So there's a Minskian super cycle. And it is in that context that reforms become possible, policy reforms become possible. They don't automatically happen. That's why Trump's election is so interesting, actually. Because there's a kind of a dialectical process, and I've never seen a more extreme dialectical process in my own history as between Obama and Trump. And the question is the synthesis of that, right? And we can talk about that later. But you have this context. So you have this phase that emerges out of how this deflation crisis was resolved between 1979 and 1982. I don't want to get into many details, but you can look it up in the book. But the resolution was through substantial deregulation of finance, which started already earlier. There was a reference made to the introduction of floating exchange rates. There was in 73, 74, you have the deregulation of capital controls. The crucial moment is 79, when you have the deregulation of interest rates in the US, and then followed by slower reforms of removing the structural regulations that kept different parts of finance apart, the so-called Glass-Steagall Act, which ironically was first removed in Europe and then followed later in the US. That's in the 80s and 90s. As a result of which you get universal banks, for which I will talk some more later. So you get in this process, and this is like the birth of finance capitalism, you get a simultaneous deregulation, globalization, and computerization of finance. And that transforms and transforms it with the emergence of finance and capitalism. Now, this creates a problem, right, for us that is a very, very interesting and challenging problem, which is to figure out what is finance. How do we define it? We cannot really define finance and capitalism nor financialization without having a pretty good sense of what finance is, right? And that is at the heart of the different heterodox approaches, right, and how they're trying to deal with this, right? Because what we need to do is we need to kind of put together production exchange in the notion of a monetary production economy, organized as interdependent cash flows, and then realize that finance is the mobilizer of these cash flows, because at the heart it is a payment system, and it is a liquidity provision system, and it is a system that allows then interwoven monetary circuits to be followed and settled by double entry bookkeeping. And so it's very important to keep that in mind. And it's not really often well enough understood. So there's still a good amount of theoretical work to be done as to how to bring together what we call the real economy with, and make it a non-real economy in the sense that it is actually a totally monetized economy, and then connect money and credit. Right? So we need to connect production, money, and credit to get a proper view of the capitalist dynamic. And I think that all of our contributions, I've seen these slides, I've seen Janet's slides, I've seen my own slides, try to do this in some way or another, right? If you do that, then you see finance already placed at the center, and your work has done that too, right? You see it placed in the center of the system, and you see it, and this is also important, right? You see it differently than standard theory as a system, as an integrated system that is both spatial, structured social space in different relations, monetary relations that are relations of interdependence and conflict, and it also structures time as historic time. You have to spend money now in order to make more money later. And so you get spatial and temporal organization that is actually an organization of finance. That's what finance organizes. Through this being the payment system, the liquidity provision system, and the double entry bookkeeping system, which are the three kind of essential functions of finance. And before we can get to the provision of credit and financial innovations, we have to understand it like that. And that requires us to do something which I refer to as mesoeconomic analysis. Okay? Because this is how you connect individual actors who are actors in this interwoven web of cash flows, where each somebody's expense becomes somebody else's income. That's how it connects us to the macro level, right, of the national economy. And so finance is in between the two. In between, it connects the two. It connects micro and macro. And it is precisely because of that that standard economic theory cannot understand it. Because in standard economic theory, micro is just a linear aggregation of macro. And all the economists who have broken through this, including Austrian school, right? All the economists who have broken out of this linear aggregation had to understand finance, had to understand money. And so all the great economists start with money. Right? Marx, Keynes, Schumpeter, Minsky, you name it, right? It's because the standard theory doesn't see what they see, which is a monetized economy in forward motion. So my approach was to try to explain finance and capitalism with two new dimensions. One was mesoeconomic, which is finance as a system, and then also to rethink the world economy. One aspect of financial, I call this meta-economics, right? Where the world economy, thanks to the incredible amount of short-term financial flows between countries, is now much more than the sum of its parts, the sum of all the national economies. The world economy has its own financialized global growth pattern, which has not been analyzed very much at all, right? And which requires a kind of a revolution in thinking that we need to have, so what I call meta-economic analysis. So, if you think of finance as a system, and I will talk to you only about the meta-economic dimension today, then you try to understand financialization as the expression of that, and put it into a sort of an integrated view. And the integrated view is a phenomenon of financial centralization, a parallel phenomenon of financial concentration, their interaction in a financialized growth dynamic, and to the extent that the financialized growth dynamic has a global reach, it hits into a system of monetary fragmentation, which is what our international monetary system is today. So this then allows certain things to be kind of clarified, right? Financial concentration interacting with financial centralization into a financialized growth dynamic that then becomes asymmetrically organized in the international monetary system as we're moving away from the dollar-based monopoly. So let's talk a little bit first about financial centralization. And this basically involves the non-financial institutions or actors, households, and let's say enterprises. And just in terms of an empirical fact, you know, over time, those non-financial actors are increasingly dependent on, reliant on financial assets and liabilities. They become richly financialized themselves. And they also draw increasing amounts of income from finance. Right? Whether it's earning dividends or interest, paid interest. Financial income, financial assets, financial liabilities become more and more important in the state of affairs of both households and enterprises. And there are several reasons for these trends, okay? And I think they are, from a social, economic, social, demographic, and political point of view, extremely important processes. One of the phenomena, and this starts in the U.S., but spreads surely through the world, is that middle-class households even become financial investors. And that has to do with the fact that the primary form of saving, I'll discuss this a bit later, goes from bank deposits to funds. And you get a variety of funds. You get first pension funds, then mutual funds, hedge funds, and then private equity funds. Different funds do different things, obviously, but we're moving away from classic traditional forms of savings to new types of savings that are, let's call them, funds, right? And part of this gets encouraged by policy, and one of the important changes there was to make capital gains taxed in the U.S. a lot less taxed than other forms of income, which then encourages the chase of capital gains. And that's why I have the importance of written statute forms. And Trump will dramatically expand that, by the way. That's one of the very few concrete policies that we know of, is that he will dramatically expand that. But there's another story to this that I have not kind of mentioned too much, but I want to warn you about this because it's an important story. Much of the transformation of middle-class households into financial investors has to also do with how the welfare states get organized into forced savings outlets. And this starts already with pension funds in the U.S. The state pension funds are not adequate, they're not adequately funded. So everybody who wants to have a pension that is reasonable has to have a private pension fund. Right? Luckily the ones for professors is very good. But for many it's not. And it's a kind of a forced savings agreement that you have with your employer, right? A portion of your wage gets automatically driven into this fund, right? And then there was a change from the classic pension fund into mutual funds, which then move the risk of those funds all the way to the from the employer to the employees. That's another story, right? But you will see, for example, healthcare. It will start slowly here, where you get, the state healthcare system is kind of gradually disintegrating, and then you're going to get private health savings plans. Right? And with Obamacare being abolished in the U.S. within the next 6 months, it will be, the idea is for the Republicans is to replace them with healthcare savings plans. Right? Where your physical risk of ill health gets then matched or contradicted by the financial risks of your healthcare savings plan. And you have time when you get sick and how sick you want to get. But that may then make you, in the Republican mind, more responsible. Right? If you know that you can't afford this kind of treatment, then maybe you should stop smoking, or maybe you should stop drinking, or maybe you should stop stressing or whatever. The jokes aside, right? As part of the financialized system, we will move with the demographic shifts between old and young people, also adding to this problem, we will move to a kind of privatization and financialization of what used to be a guaranteed welfare state. And the big leap will come when we go into the internet economy and most of our workers become independent contractors that cannot survive unless they have a wage insurance fund. That is more important, right? So you're going to have a wage insurance fund that you have to participate in so that we have the kind of mobility of the kind of workforce that no longer has regular jobs. Okay? So all of this is part of an evolution. And in that sense, it's important to understand that we always talk about the Gini coefficient and all that, and we have to put the emphasis on the incredible wealth of accumulation of the top 5% in the world, and they reap like 70% of the benefits of globalization. And of course, the 30% that are not are going to get really pissed off. The 95% that only get the 30% gain. Organization are getting very pissed off, and that's why you get Brexit, and that's why you get Trump, and that's why you're going to get Le Pen or whatever. Right? Who knows who you're going to get in Brazil? So there's a massive destabilization politically in the process because of that, right? But to get back to the point that I was trying to make, this financialization is, this particular dimension of financialization is just part of an evolution that will stay with us and intensify to the extent that the governments become paralyzed politically as well. There's this kind of negative feedback effect where governments become politically destabilized and that can no longer provide the minimum of the welfare state, the integrated system. And so they will then transfer more and more of the burden in terms of this tax-advantaged savings account. And people will buy it. People will buy it because they're tax-advantaged. There's going to be incentives for this, right? And people look at incentives before they look at the risks. That's the danger. So That's one thing. The other thing that is clearly dominant in the financial centralization process is on the side of the firms, corporations. This was a dramatic process in the US in the 1980s with the first big bubble, shared with the corporate raiders. The corporate raiders used junk bonds to attack the largest companies in the US and then established, through this wave of attacks, which became increasingly speculative, shareholder value maximization as the sole criteria of corporate governance in the US. So in a period of 10, 15 years, the way corporations were thinking and prioritizing and structure totally changed. We don't give enough credence and importance to this particular part of the history, the story. And this has to do also with the funds. The funds become institutional investors and they represent the savings of the population, and they oblige firms to make maximizing the share price at any given moment the sole criteria of performance judgment. And this transforms firms. Apart from the fact that, you know, that the top managers get paid in shares from stock options, the companies become basically asset funds. They think of this under this pressure, they don't think of the product as much as, you know, how do I manage the assets in the best fashion that I can give my shareholder value maximization requests from my shareholders or my owners the right kind of answer. And so companies organize as holding companies. Companies shuffle assets around constantly. When they have cash, they buy back shares. And part of the process is global supply chains, right? When you know and when you have centralized control at the holding company, the core of the company is the holding company, the center. Everything else is just subsidiaries that can mix together, dispense with, reorganize, or whatever. At the core, the company is a cash collection agent. That's the holding company. And when the company knows that it can control financially its cash flows and centralize them and then redeploy them, then it can also do much more massive decentralization of production. And it can basically also outsource all of production. And this is important. Because this allows firms, it gives them liberties and attack options and realization options much faster, right? And they also think increasingly just in terms of external growth strategies, right? Rather than building their own factories or research and development, they just buy it as shares, right? From other units. And ultimately, this leads to global production networks, alliances of firms, and global oligopolization. We end up, you know, in this process, going from 100 car companies to 5 worldwide over a period of 50 years, right? And maybe 2 or 3 cell phone makers, or whatever. Right? That's a powerful process. It explains a lot in terms of the globalization of production that requires this kind of globalization of finance. So this is financial concentration. Parallel to this has to be accommodated, right, and it has to be integrated into the financial centralization process. You have also the transformation of finance itself, and that's financial concentration. On the surface, what financial concentration really means, if you want to measure it, and José has already given us some interesting data there, but it really means that finance takes a larger share of GDP. The income extracted by finance, the portion of the total profit created by the economy that goes to finance gets bigger and bigger. And also, you have increased concentration in a narrowly defined way. You know, the the bigger institutions, the bigger banks take a bigger share of the market share. Right? You get fewer and fewer banks. And driving this process are two parallel changes that we can sort of call the transformation of financial capital. One I already mentioned, which is that savings no longer are bank deposits, as they used to work, they are funds. Funds become the vehicle for savings. And parallel to this, securities take the place of loans as the primary form of credit. I can give you a long story about why and how, and the whole process of securitization, and I'm not going to do that here, we can talk about that if you want to. Right? This gets organized by universal banks. Universal banks are banks that, thanks to deregulation, can now integrate together the different aspects of finance. Commercial banking, which is indirect, we call it indirect finance, which is a classic type of finance where you take bank deposits then make loans. Investment banking, which is the organization of financial markets. Insurance, fund management, all these different functions of finance get integrated in universal banks, through universal banks. And this transforms the way banks work. That's crucially important. That's the key part of financial concentration. Because when you can take previously separated part of finance and put them together, then 1 + 1 + 1 is not 3. 1 + 1 + 1 is like 5 or 6. So you get this kind of boost. And this is a matter of economies of scale, but also of economies of scope, and above all, of network economies. And the way that universal banks, the whole banking system is structured as a hierarchy called the correspondence system, and it's globally organized. So you have about 450 universal banks in the world. And then you have about 60 or 70 of them that are really the dominant ones. And so this is an incredibly concentrated system. And through that system pass $5.5-6 trillion every day. Right? So this is the nerve center of capitalism. And what's interesting is to see how in the run-up to the great crisis of 2007, how universal banks organized themselves, right? And how they were integrating these different parts of finance. Right? So to me, a large part of this book that I wrote is to show how this gets integrated, right? And how, most importantly, was the invisible part, which is shadow banking, which is about a third of the total. So you have this new development, this new type of finance, network finance, which we call now shadow banking, but to me it's better called network finance. And what I'm currently working on right now is to understand how those three parts of finance, indirect finance, market finance, network finance, how they get integrated before the crisis and how they got changed after the crisis. Right? And crucial to this is the money creation process. So I'm trying to understand money creation and the hierarchies of monies. Because I work on fictitious capital, and already in those notes in chapter 29 of Marx's third volume, Marx says in just a little paragraph that one aspect of fictitious capital is credit money itself. Right? And this is something that has been stuck in my mind forever. The first time I read it, I was like 18 years old. Right? And I was like, what the hell? And then I found it later in Hayek too. Hayek also calls this fictitious capital. Right? He does it for a very different reason, by the way, than Marx did. But he also is interesting too. So this is crucial, right? Because this has to do with liquidity. And the liquidity provision dimension of finance, as it integrates those three different aspects of three different systems of minds into one. And right now what I'm trying to do is to figure out how shadow banking creates money, what type of money, repos, asset-backed commercial paper, money market funds, shares. So and as I was doing this work, by the way, there's better people than me, Daniela Gabor and Sultan Pozar, that would come to mind here. But how I distinguish my work on this from them is that I realize there's three different types of liquidity corresponding to three different types of finance with three different types of money. And so I'm stuck with this idea that you have funding liquidity, market liquidity, and monetary liquidity. And I'm trying to see how those three get integrated. And I'm trying to do this by looking at the balance sheets within the universal banking system in terms of the interconnections between the indirect finance part, the market finance part, and the negative finance part, which is quite an exciting piece of work. But I don't want to bore you with that because I'm not giving you enough details. So the point is, the other dimension that is important here is that the universal banks, this hardcore finance, right, they work like a cartel. They compete, but they also cooperate. And they control, above all, they like to have collective control over markets and networks that they create. And this interaction between control, cooperation, and competition allows them to extract monopoly rights. So they have, if they work, they work in a very profitable way. And of course, a lot of this, ultimately, beyond fees and commissions and dividends and interest, has to do with the chase for capital gains, which I'm going to get into when we talk about the next slide, which is the financial growth path. So you have financial growth. I mean, I know I have to hurry up. Right? One classic argument on the left is the juxtaposition between financial explosion and industrial stagnation. That's especially, I mean, you have Bellamy Foster, which is a sort of modern capital, American tradition of Marxism, and you also have some post-gamers like Stockhammer. I personally don't really buy that too much because that runs counter to my idea of the long wave upswing. And I can explain why I would criticize this. But one thing that's very, very important too in that argument is that the short-termism of corporations mixed with their vision of themselves as just asset bundles prevents them from thinking long-term and doing the kind of long-term investments that are crucial for ultimately for the growth dynamic, which is to invest in the workforce, to spend more on research and development, and more basic research and applied research, and not just on development, to invest in their communities that they want to be in, etc., etc., etc. That does get crowded out because of the big take of shareholder value maximization. On that level, I agree that there is a problem there. And this problem becomes very dramatic in the next period, in the next phase, when we have to face climate change. I'll talk about that tomorrow. The other part that's often emphasized in the financial growth dynamic, and this was already was quite clearly demonstrated by José Carlos Braga, is the inequality that comes with financialization. Right? But we're focusing, in my view, too much on personal income distribution. And we do not focus enough on functional income distribution. And what drives the growth dynamic more is functional income distribution. Of course, personal distribution also drives the growth dynamic, right? You arrive at Guarulhos Airport, and before you get out of the Shahida sign, you're walking through this luxury supermarket, right? Where you have to, like, you know, I was here at 6 in the morning, people are buying like that, right? Yes. And I was watching who's buying and who's not buying. Not the families, right? So there is a luxury, I mean, yes, you know, you can wear Burberry and Prada. And the other side of that is the destruction of mass markets, right? You get these class-distinguished markets, right? Target, Walmart, there's like a hierarchy of supermarkets in the US, right? That's part of a more unequal society, yes? Just internet access, cell phone access, these things are all part of it. Yes, I agree. But much more important is functional redistribution, okay? Because that sets up a growth pattern that is totally unique to the finance that capital. The first aspect of that is that you have declining wage shares in all OECD countries over long periods of time. I think there's one or two in Scandinavia where this is not the case. But if I look, if I remember the stats correctly that we did in the survey two or three years ago, you had long-term declining wage shares. And the only way you don't have slow growth or a crisis is if you have export-led growth. You can have export-led growth for a while if you can overcome this contradiction, this Marxian contradiction, that the wage is simultaneously a private cost to be kept at a minimum by the business, and at the same time it's the largest source of social aggregate demand. So the businesses would all like to have the wages of their workers to be as low as possible and the wages of all the other workers to be as high as possible because they're consumers. But the wage gets determined on a micro level, okay? Especially when you destroy unions. Right? The beauty of the unions was that they kind of leveled up the meso level. And this is no longer the case. Right? We don't have that anymore. So there's this contradiction. How do you then get out of being effort in your aggregate demand side, you have the export-led growth. And the export-led growth was possible for the majority of countries that needed it because the US became the US. With the dollar as world money became the buyer of the last resort. And then I can get to later. But this is absolutely crucial to the story. The US could spend $107 for every $100 that it created. And those $7 absorb three quarters of the world's surpluses. This is how you could integrate 3 billion people and make them into emerging market economies. This is how you could tell Brazil the giant has awoken. And this is also how you could build a commodity super cycle on top of it that made it even stronger. Because what's important here is this international monetary system and its monetary fragmentation, which is a key part of this crisis. But anyway, so I want to explain to you that in the functional redistribution story, you have basically a redistribution from wages to financial income. And the way it normally works, okay, is that financial income extractors put more pressure on industrial profits. This is one reason why you have this shareholder value maximization, companies as asset funders, right? They respond to that. But they also respond to get their share back into shape, which they're under pressure to do from finance. Finance not only takes a bigger share, but puts pressure on saying, you still have to have enough profits, you still have to have enough profits, right? And so then they are under more pressure to then shaft labor. And the only way the workers can somehow kind of live with this, right, is save less, but more remunerative through funds, work longer hours, and go into debt. And then household debt becomes also a big part of the story, as much as the collapse of savings that we've seen in this growth pattern. But the collapse of savings can be compensated by the wealth effect of living in assets that are rising in price, right? So if you turn middle-income people at the same time not only into more debtors, but at the same time also into financial investors that are now no longer just looking at low interest rates in the savings accounts in the bank, but they're thinking about the capital gains in the stock market or the capital gains from housing, then the whole thing can kind of live for 25 years, right? If you can have a fast-growing economy despite falling wage shares. And that's what happened. So there's a pretty complex growth pattern there. And the key to this growth pattern was that On the one hand, you organize a debt economy with everybody taking more debt, and financial innovations allowing them to live with more debt. That's the credit default swaps, for example, allow you to insure against the counterparty's debt. When you securitize loans, you just accelerate the turnover of loans, so you can, banks can then lend more. Right? They don't have to wait for mortgage 20 years, they're waiting literally just 20 minutes before they've sold off that loan. Right? So all these different innovations that allow us to basically live with higher levels of debt. And then you need to go back to Minsky and realize that the super cycle work of his was actually as important as the financial security hypothesis, right? Because the financial security hypothesis would get anybody very soon to this Ponzi position, right? But now you have ways to delay the Ponzi position. That is the financial fragile position, right? So we have to factor all of these things in to get to the final point, which is the global dynamic, which is so the meta dynamic, right? Where you become a bubble economy at the same time as you become a debt economy. And the debt often is used to launch these bubbles. And the bubbles emanate from the US. There's a center-periphery dynamic. And it's precisely this dynamic that if the US issues world money, the dollar gets created within the domestic banking system and gets exported. Okay? And it flows out through American deficits. And American deficits get automatically funded by the rest of the world using dollars, right? So the US not only has no external constraint, but it has automatic funding of its deficits by the rest of the world. And that's how the US can basically then live beyond its needs. Okay? And the way it lives beyond its needs is by the mobilization of bubbles, consecutive bubbles. And the bubbles are consecutive in the sense of how the government reacts to the collapse of each bubble by helping to launch the next bubble. And so we have three bubbles. When you go back to Braga's curves, right, you have all these rise, and then you have this zigzag at the top, right, in the last 10, 15 years. Those are your three bubbles, right? Those are your three bubbles. Almost all the data that we showed there show those zigzag three bubbles. I'm almost done. The most important bubble ultimately became the bubble of households tied to their homes. Okay. And this is the subprime crisis. This is the end of the upswing. This is the systemic crisis. But this is the bubble that allowed the world economy to grow for quite some time. It's a deep bubble. Because 60-some percent of Americans own their homes, and they could then basically use their homes like an automated cash machine. For a period of 12 years, ultimately. But this bubble collapses, and then the world goes down in tubes. I also want to put one little point aside. In the shadow banking system is outside of government supervision, therefore beyond government control, and therefore not insured by the government. The other systems are insured. And the market finance system is semi-insured by the government, semi-insured by the market makers themselves. But shadow banking is not. So shadow banking had its own private insurance systems, mechanisms. It had the ratings agencies, it had the normal mine insurers, it had the repos, collateral, it had a whole bunch of private insurance mechanisms. What's fascinating is that when the crisis happened inside the shadow banking system, with the mortgage-backed securities, all one after the other of these assurance mechanisms failed to work. And therefore the shadow banking system is integrated, and that's how you got the systemic crisis. Right? And two things, and then I'm done. One thing is that the governments reacted very well. They didn't see it coming. They didn't understand it was a systemic crisis for about 6 months. But once Bernanke in particular got the fact that this was a systemic crisis, and by the way, it was a studied debt crisis before. He was a great economic historian and the mention of deflation. So he was the right man at the right moment. But also through the upgrading of the G20 mechanism, the governments responded in a coordinated fashion to avoid this crisis from doing what the systemic crisis usually does, which is to go into a debt inflation spiral. We avoided that. But we have still a kind of a slow motion alternative debt inflation spiral. Okay? And the problem has to do with quantitative easing by one zone, depreciating that currency, appreciating other currencies, and then basically moving the problem to the other blocks with those currencies that are going up. They have their crisis, and then they then have to do quantitative easing. And that's exactly how, you know, the crisis went from the US to Europe to China to Brazil. You're basically living in this, you know, gradual globalization of a structural systemic crisis, right? Which can take 20 years to unfold. And that's kind of painful to live through. So we have this, and this is in the long way of the dynamic, this makes total sense. You've got to go through this period of a long term crisis, right? This then gets me to the point of now we have a debate in the US about secular stagnation. The American economists are kind of beginning to understand, whoa, we're living in this like slow growth path. What do we do? And Trump is, I mean, one of the things that motivated people to vote for Trump was that he promised a huge fiscal stimulus, okay? And which we'll see whether it gets done, okay? And we will also see if it gets done, what kind of consequences there are, right? But there's all kinds of secular stagnation arguments, and I have my, you know, I'm listing three here, I have my doubts about each one of them. I like best Richard Kuhn's balance sheet recession, which is about deleveraging and the patrons of deleveraging. But the key is that you have a global overproduction crisis. If you look at the tradable sectors, both and above all manufacturing, but also key services, we have between 20% and 50% overcapacity in really all the sectors. There's only a few sectors where you don't have that. So we have a global overproduction crisis. And it is in that context that we need to understand and think through globally coordinated policies to get out of this and into the next accumulation regime, which I should call eco-capitalism, in which I will talk about tomorrow. Thank you.